We turn now in our consideration of the second part of Paul's second missionary journey to his ministry in the two great Greek cities of Athens and Corinth. His ministry in Athens recorded in the second half of Acts chapter 17 and Corinth chapter 18 verses 1 to 12. Before considering his ministry in Athens, let me say something about this most significant of ancient cities. It was the intellectual metropolis of the ancient world, the very cradle of democracy, the world's cultural capital. Its history was glorious. In the 5th century BC, it had taken a leading part in resisting the Persian invasions, and the fleet of Athens had saved Greece from that cruel Oriental power. It was then recognized as foremost among the city-states of Greece and had a very powerful maritime empire stretching over the Aegean Sea, the coast of Ionia, as it was called, and as far west as Sicily. Athens was defeated by Sparta and their allies. Here's Sparta, the bottom of the Peloponnese, in what is called the Peloponnesian War, 431 to 404 BC. But even after this military defeat, it still retained much of its cultural influence. The Romans allowed the city to remain a free city and, as I've said, the cultural capital of the Mediterranean world. The sculpture and the literature and the oratory of the 5th and 4th centuries BC have never been surpassed, I believe, in human history, and they're still regarded as the standard by which all other endeavours in these fields are judged. It was a centre of philosophy. Socrates and Plato, the great philosophers, were citizens of Athens, and it was the adopted home of later philosophers such as Aristotle, Epicurus, and Zeno, the Stoic. The language of Athens, Attic Greek, formed the basis of Koine Greek, which itself is the foundation Greek of the New Testament. So we need to remember just the magnificence of the culture of this city into which this little bandy-legged preacher came after a journey down from northern Greece. W.M. Taylor has a very striking paragraph at this point in his exposition, and I quote him in full. Here were the very highest places of human wisdom, the very perfection of human art, the very centre of human culture. And yet, after all, how little those material splendours and that mental training seemed to affect the moral and spiritual condition of the people. For they were sunk in superstition and impurity. Taylor goes on, men tell us that the world is to be elevated by culture, and they turn away from the gospel as a vulgar thing. But let them look below the surface of the Athens which Paul visited, or the Rome which Nero ruled. Let them study the Italy of Leo X, or the France of Louis XIV, and they will find that art, literature, philosophy, aesthetics may all be cultivated to the highest extent, while morally the heart is a cage of unclean beasts, and socially the community is reeking with rottenness. So true is it that the world by wisdom knows not God. That's a very valid point that Taylor's making. Never, and I know I'm prejudiced, but I think that never did human civilization and culture reach a higher peak than it did in Athens. And if ever a man was to redeem himself and to make his own utopia, it would be in Athens. And yet, as Taylor says, the community was reeking with moral rottenness. And it's a dramatic scene. If you're preaching that, you'd have to use your imagination. Get a few pictures of Athens, look at the city, look at its geography and its contours and the buildings that even still remain. I had the privilege of living for a year in Athens, studying at the university, and you know, it was a funny feeling to get off the bus each morning at the Acropolis or say to somebody, I'll meet you at the Parthenon and we'll go and have a cup of coffee. It seemed strange, but think of the magnificence of that city. There was a great statue of Athena on the Parthenon, and it could be seen for miles and miles around, and as Paul would be approaching the city, he'd see the great golden statue. And think of that little man coming into the city with the gospel in his heart. Mm-hmm. That's the contrast. Mm-hmm. The intellectual capital of the world and the preacher of the gospel. Paul seems to have been alone when he entered Athens. I believe that what has happened is that he left Luke at Philippi. I should have mentioned, although you could have implied it from the references, that the "we" section ended as they left Philippi. So Luke met them at Troas, went to Philippi, and then he isn't with them when they leave Philippi. I think the strong implication is that he's stayed behind to care for the Christians. Timothy was probably left at Thessalonica. 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 2. Well, in chapter 3 he says, Timothy has just come to us from you and has brought good news about your faith and love. So Timothy at some stage has been with them. And Silas has been left at Berea. So his companions have been left along the road in the different cities. Paul is by himself. And as he enters, we are told, and as he lives in the city, we're told in verse 16 that he was greatly distressed in his spirit to see that the city was full of idols. And the verb is the same root as this paroxysmos that we had this morning. Paroxunato to pneuma autu en auto. His spirit was moved to disturbance and bitterness to see that the city was full of idols. Paul was not destitute of a sense of beauty. He was not anti-culture. But he asked himself, what is this culture saying? And I needn't describe the idols of Athens of the day. They were unspeakably vile. The actual way the sculptures were made of men and women were vile. They had religious significance and moral depravity. Homosexuality abounded. And you'd all these statues of lewd and lascivious gods. A wit, one of the Greek wits, had made the epigram in the light of the moral perversion of the city that at Athens it was easier to find a god than a man. You see the implication there, the double entendre. The city just totally corrupt and surrounded by these gods. I don't apologize for quoting again from Taylor. Listen to his application. Ah, how like Athens are our modern cities. And yet, how quietly we take it. Multitudes are bowing at the shrine of money. Many are doing homage in the temple of fame. Thousands are wallowing in the mire of sensuality. While at every street corner there is a temple erected to Bacchus. But where are the Pauls? Where are the spirits stirred into activity by the sight of the wretchedness that reigns around? There are too many among us calling themselves by the name of Christ who let the black tide of sin and misery roll past them without one thought of rescuing a single victim from the waves or doing anything to dry up the waters. And one of the speakers at the Leicester Conference last year I think it was Morris Roberts told us of one of the great Scottish preachers who used to pause in the middle of the city of Glasgow and go into to a little entry and weep and pray. He was just oppressed as he walked through that great city and just looked at everything around him and thought of the lostness of it all. And Paul comes to Athens and he's not doing the tourist trip. He's not going around all the different sites. He's grieved, he's burdened, he's disturbed. And which of us could travel through New York, through London, through any of the great capitals of the world without feeling the same grief and burden? So much magnificence, so much genius and technology and culture, and at the same time such utter darkness and lostness. Paul begins to witness in the synagogue, verse 17, apparently with little result. And then in aggressive, imaginative evangelism, he goes out to the marketplace, the Agora, at the foot of the Acropolis, where the citizens of Athens met to exchange news, to debate, and to talk. And day after day, he goes and preaches and reasons and witnesses there. He meets a group of philosophers, the Epicureans and the Stoics, and I'm sure you cover these philosophies in your New Testament introduction. These men talk to him and they describe him, verse 18, as a babbler. The Greek word is spermologos, a picker of seeds. It's a slang Athenian expression for someone who retails scraps of second hand learning. I hope that's not a typical seminary student. A charlatan who retails scraps of second hand learning. Another dictionary translates it as a rogue who picks up scraps from the gutter and hawks other men's ideas because he is too lazy or dull to have his own. So these people describe Paul as some sort of a charlatan or a preacher of false gods. And they ask him to come and explain his views before the Areopagus. The ancient Athenian court had once been a senate but was still very prestigious. This court exercised control over religion, morals and so on in the city. So Paul is brought to the Areopagus and is asked to expound fully and formally the doctrines which he has been preaching. Just think of it. Think of the obstacles. First of all, he's a foreigner, and the Greeks were a very bigoted people. He is unimpressive in appearance, and the Greeks paid a great deal of attention to physical beauty and handsomeness. He is unskilled in speaking, that is to say, in the classic Greek oratory, and he is a very difficult subject for his audience, and a subject that they're not liable to want to hear. What a challenge. What a difficult task for Paul. He's no companions. He's on his own. I suppose I'd better not take that line of thought any further. A foreigner of unimpressive appearance, unskilled in speaking, on his own. However, he stands there and he preaches to the Athenians. And I want to note just five aspects of his preaching. First of all, in verses 22 and 23, we have the point of contact, what we might call the introduction. Paul stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious." He uses there an extremely rare Greek word, which was used by the Greek dramatist Aeschylus in his play The Eumenides. His play The Eumenides means the Furies.
Did you hear about the man went to the Greek tailor with a pair of trousers with a tear in them? And the tailor said to him, "Euripides?" And he said, "Yes, Eumenides." Sorry. But that was the play at the Eumenides. And I think that's deliberate on Paul's part. He's using a word, a buzzword, a key word, a word that an ordinary person wouldn't know. These people will prick up their ears. This fellow has read this play. Dicedaimonesteros. Very religious, very superstitious. I see that you're very religious. For as I walked around and observed your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, "To an unknown God." Now what you worship is something unknown, I am going to proclaim to you. His introduction is conciliatory. It's not aggressive. It's not off-putting. It is also accurate and honest. It is topical. They're surrounded by the statues of the gods. And it leads ideally into what he wants to say. And he interprets this slogan, "To an unknown God," as a confession of ignorance on their part. He convicts them out of their own mouths and from their own statues. There is the statue, "To an unknown God." You're admitting that there's a God you don't know. You see, the genius of the introduction, well, they can't deny that. They are admitting there is a God they don't know. In fact, they've put up a statue to this God they don't know, and they've put a label underneath it. There is a God whom they do not know. And his purpose is coming is to dispel their ignorance. So it's a very skillful introduction. He doesn't denounce their idolatry at once. He doesn't antagonize them needlessly. Sometimes men think that honesty demands sort of a crude bluntness that just sets people's teeth on edge and irritates them. And they say, "I'm being faithful to the gospel." Well, that's not faithful. That's foolish. It's like a man who went to the psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist said, "What's your problem?" And he said, "Well, somehow I just can't seem to get on with people, fat face." Well, I mean, there are Christians like that, and they just antagonize you, and they don't realize they're doing it. Well, Paul doesn't do that, and Paul has got courage. Paul can be bold. But he begins in a very conciliatory way, and he gains their attention. And then he begins to preach. Now, what is the first head of his sermon? It is the doctrine of God. That's interesting, isn't it? He begins to preach with the doctrine of God. This is his evangelistic emphasis. And he preaches, first of all, that God is creator. God is creator. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth. Here is a powerful statement which makes no concession whatever to Hellenistic paganism. He's quoting perhaps from Genesis 14, verses 19 and 23. You remember that God is described as, by Melchizedek, as God Most High, creator of heaven and earth. So God is the creator. Psalm 24:1, "The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof." He has made all things. There's no division between the material and the spiritual. It all comes from God. So he preaches the creatorhood of God. Then he preaches the spirituality of God. The spirituality of God. He does not live in temples built by hands. Very touching reminiscence of Stephen's phrase. That sermon of Stephen's had burnt its way into Paul's soul. You remember how Stephen had made precisely the same point before the Jews? Paul had heard it And here he says he's not worshipped in temples made by hands. The creatorhood of God, the spirituality of God, and the self-sufficiency of God. He is not served by human hands as if he needed anything. God, supreme and self-sufficient in himself. You remember Psalm 50, verses 9 to 12. I have no need of a bull from your stall. Every animal of the forest is mine. If I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world is mine and all that is in it. So he sets before them a radically new conception of God. That's the beginning of his preaching. And isn't that one of the notes that we need to stress today? Because the God whom people talk about is an unknown God. And they have no idea who God is or what God is like. And it's utter folly to go into a congregation and to think that when you say God and they say God, you're talking about the same being. They do not know. The vast majority of our fellow citizens have no idea who God is or what he's like. And we're back in Athens day. Paul begins with the doctrine of God. He doesn't say, well, it's evangelism, you know, a few jokes and a few stories and a poem. And, you know, they can't take any heavy theology. He plunges straight in and lays it out before them. And then he moves on, secondly, to the doctrine of man. Verse 26, man is one from one creator. No racial superiority here. Man is controlled and blessed by God's providence. He decides the nations where they live. He determines their times and the bounds of their habitation. And this is all done so that men might find God who is near them. So he's pressing that man is a creature dwelling in God's presence, sustained by God's power, created by God, formed by God. And he reinforces what he is saying with two extremely searching and brilliant quotations from the Greek poets. You see them in verse 28. For in him we live and move and have our being. That's a quotation. And then, as some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. Now let me read you the fuller context of these quotations, because they are superlatively brilliant and pointed and show Paul's understanding of classical literature. And he's talking to literary men. The first quotation is from a poem written by a Cretan called Epimenides. Now, the point is, this is a poem to Zeus, the great high god of the Greeks. And in this poem, Epimenides is denouncing his fellow Cretans because they claim that the tomb of Zeus was in Crete. That Zeus, the great high god, was buried in Crete. And Epimenides is writing to show them that this is folly. So you see already the parallels. This is a Greek poem written to show that God cannot be buried. And you'll recognize, as I read the verse of the poem, you'll recognize how Paul later on another occasion quotes again from the same verse. Here's what Epimenides says. They fashioned a tomb for thee, O high and holy one. The Cretans, always liars, evil beasts, idle bellies. But thou art not dead. Thou livest and abidest forever. For in thee we live and move and have our being. That's an amazing statement. And you see the significance of the last line. For in thee we live and move and have our being. And if we're alive and we live in God, he can't be dead. Your very existence, Epimenides said, is a proof of the continued existence of your Creator. And you see how beautifully suited that is for the point that Paul wants to make. And then he goes on and quotes from a poem by Aratus the Stoic. Aratus is also speaking to Zeus. Let us all begin with Zeus. Never, O men, let us leave him unmentioned. Full of Zeus are all the ways and all the meeting places of men. The sea and the harbours are full of him. It is with Zeus that every one of us in every way has to do. for we are also his offspring. It is with Zeus that every one of us in every way has to do, for we are also his offspring. And when Paul made the quotation, these men knew exactly what he was saying. So he preaches the doctrine of God, the doctrine of man. He preaches the implications for worship. Verse 29, therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by man's design and skill. The argument is this: if the offspring are like this, the Father cannot be less. If the offspring are living beings, the Father cannot be of gold or stone or wood. The offspring reflects something of the being of the Father. The Father cannot be less. He cannot be lower. And he impresses upon them our responsibility to worship this God, to bow before him. And then he finally closes with a call to repentance. Verse 30. Their ignorance is culpable, but God has overlooked it. That is to say, he has used no direct and immediate means to correct it. But now he commands all men everywhere to repent, because he has appointed a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has ordained. He has given proof of this to all men by raising him from the dead. Now, this Areopagus address has been variously interpreted. Some liberal scholars have denied that it's Pauline at all. They have said that this is Luke's own composition, and that Paul's theology makes it impossible that he could have preached such a message. Albert Schweitzer, for example, said that Paul's emphasis is on being in Christ by grace. This address reflects an emphasis on being in God by nature. But I think if you look, for example, at the first three chapters of the book of Romans, you will see a very, very close parallel between Paul's address in Athens and his statement in the first three chapters. What are the notes in those first three chapters? The knowledge of God from creation. The created things speak to us of the invisible God. The inexcusability of man. God's forbearance in passing over the sins of the past. The new era which has dawned with Christ. It's the same themes, the same notes are being stressed. It has also been claimed by evangelical commentators that this address was a mistake. That Paul here went astray, his rationalism and his logic led him astray. It has been pointed out that there is no mention of the cross, that he relies on pagan authorities and quotes godless poets. And the contention is that as he left Athens, he realized that he had failed, and he decided on the road to Corinth that he was going to change his approach. And when he came to Corinth, he said, I was determined to know nothing among you save Jesus Christ and him crucified. 1 Corinthians 2:2. Now again, I think that is a misreading of what Paul is doing in Athens. And I think we're quite wrong to consider this as a sort of a rationalistic mistake. The speech here on the Areopagus is not Paul's complete evangelistic message and apologetic. It is a preparation. It's not a word I often use, but it is in a sense pre-evangelism. He has not reached a place where the word of the cross would have any meaning to his pagan audience. I mean, it is not faithful to say things to people that they cannot understand. To come to somebody who's never opened a Bible in their life and say, are you under the blood of the Lamb? I mean, that is folly. That's not gospel preaching. So for Paul to start talking about the cross before he had laid the foundations and the groundwork would have been folly. He is preaching God. Preaching him as creator, sustainer, and judge. This is biblical preaching. This is, in the broad sense, true evangelism. He doesn't quote these poets as authorities in their own right. They simply provide a point of contact. And above all, I think the Achilles heel of this contention, you see, they're saying that Paul wanted to be respectable to the Athenians. He didn't want to say anything they would laugh at. And so he was ashamed of the cross of Christ, and he wrongly and sinfully left it out. But note that he preached the resurrection. And if there was anything more ludicrous and ridiculous, you couldn't imagine it. And as soon as they heard it, they burst out laughing. So Paul wasn't ashamed. Paul wasn't hiding anything that he felt he didn't have the courage to preach. He was judging his opportunity. He was shaping what he wanted to say to his audience. And men, I think we have to covet this sanctified flexibility. There is no one way to preach a sermon or to preach the gospel. And we have to be sensitive to the people we're speaking to, and to seek to express ourselves in a way that they will understand. I know that's a dangerous tightrope to walk, but one of the things which could stifle the Reformed movement is that if we took a stereotyped idea of what preaching always is and just preached that way all the time, everywhere, that really would be folly. And we're getting back to a stage where we're going to have to do a lot more basic instruction. This idea that, you know, a pagan walks in off the street into your church building, the first time they come into the church they're converted, bang, like that. Well, I know that can happen. But is it not going to happen in the coming years that more and more often people will come for weeks and for months, and they'll hear a bit there and they'll hear a bit there, the thinking will slowly be changed, the truth will be laid down, and all that basis has to be structured before they come to faith. We must not operate on a 19th century model where most people knew the Bible pretty well. It was all there. So you could give a pretty pointed call to faith and repentance. But now, as you know, they don't know it. And these addresses, Athens and Lystra and so on, become more and more relevant for us. The results are disappointing. He is met with outright ridicule from some and polite dismissal from others. Verse 34, there are a few converts. A few men became followers of Paul and believed. We don't know of any church in Athens in the apostolic age. We read in 1 Corinthians 16 and verse 15 of Stephanas and his household, the first converts in Achaia. That would need more work, but at least the suggestion is that there was not much in the way of positive results in Paul's ministry in Athens. And that brings us then, secondly, and a little bit more briefly, to his ministry in Corinth. Recorded for us in chapter 18, verses 1 to 22. I believe that he reached the city dejected and discouraged. He had been called by God from Troas to Macedonia, but he had been driven from city after city, Philippi, Thessalonica, Berea. He had reached Athens. He'd been greeted with polite amusement, very little in the way of results. He was anxious about the small groups of converts whom he'd left in these cities. He didn't know how they were doing. Were they progressing? Were they going backwards? He was lonely. He had no friends. He was exhausted. He says, "I came to you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling." So it was a low point in his life, physically, emotionally, spiritually. The man was at a low ebb. Corinth, a very significant city. It was significant because it was the point at which ships could cross. They had built a channel with logs
on which the, it was a 3-mile channel. The Gultley Canal had not yet been built, but there was a 3-mile load of logs over which small ships could be dragged. And it saved the long, dangerous sea journey around the Peloponnese, very stormy, rocky coast. So there's a lot of trade passing down the Gulf of Corinth, over the isthmus and out. A bit like Alexandria or Panama in the 19th century. That same sort of strategic location. Corinth was a very big commercial city. It was a city of military importance. It had a reputation for great luxury and very civilized living. It also had a reputation, a well-deserved reputation, for immorality. There was a Greek verb, Corinthiazomai, to behave like a Corinthian, and that was used for the depths of vice and degradation. I visited Corinth on a number of occasions. One of the great features of the city is a hill outside the city called Acrocorinth. And there was a temple to Aphrodite or Venus on that city, on that citadel. It was staffed by 1,000 sacred prostitutes who came down into the city every evening to ply their trade. So, a very evil place. A very cosmopolitan place. Romans, Greeks, Levantines, Jews, Arabs, people from all over the world. A city of about 250,000 people in those days. So a very, very large city, a daunting place in which to witness. Paul comes to the city lonely and discouraged, and he sees the need all around him. But he is encouraged by meeting a couple who are to be significant in his later ministry, Aquila and Priscilla. They share Paul's trade. They are both leather workers or tent workers, and Paul finds employment with them. Aquila was a native of Pontus, up near the Black Sea. There we are there. His wife, Priscilla, or Prisca, as she's called in 1 Corinthians 16:9, may have been a native of Rome. And they had been compelled to leave Rome because of the edict of the Roman Emperor Claudius. They seem to have been quite a well-to-do couple, and some biblical students suggest that they may have had several branches of their business, because we find them later in Rome, in Romans 16:3, and in Ephesus, 1 Corinthians 16:19. So they carried on their business in at least these three cities. They may have had sub-offices or branches of their main work. Probably Christians before they met Paul, because he doesn't speak of them as his converts. They're always mentioned together, which is nice. Obviously a very close couple. And it's interesting that Priscilla is often mentioned before her husband. It's possible that she was the more gifted of the two, more intellectually gifted, having more insight. It's a very, very beautiful and touching thing to see a woman who is more gifted by her husband than her husband, and yet who has, by the grace of God, proper biblical submission to her husband. I think that's a delightful thing to see. And how many gracious women there are who are much more able in many ways than the men they've married, and yet who are able to have that submission. That's grace. She's not submitting because she's more stupid than her husband, because she's inferior in any way. In many ways our wives are superiors. Just as many of the people we will preach to are our superiors. We're not here because we're superior. We're here because we're appointed, because we're commanded, because we're called. We must never forget that. And this may well have been the case with Aquila and Priscilla. And perhaps, for example, when Apollos comes into their home, in the familiarity and informality of the home, then we have Priscilla able to exercise her gifts as they talk together of the things of God. And under her husband and in the home, she's able to make this valuable contribution. So they are a great strength to Paul. Their home, everywhere we see them in the New Testament, their home is always a meeting place for believers. References you might note are Acts 18:18, Romans 16:3, 2 Timothy 4:19. Paul says in Romans 16:4, they risked their lives for me. Not only I, but all the churches of the Gentiles are grateful to them. For a time then, he is engaged in manual labor all week and preaches in the synagogue each Sabbath day. Any of us can identify with that. And then in verses 5 and 6, we find good news. Silas and Timothy come from Macedonia with excellent news about the Thessalonian church. And it was at this time that Paul wrote the letters to the Thessalonians, dealing with some problems which he heard had arisen, but expressing his joy, his gratitude to God, his thanksgiving for the work of God in building those churches. They may have come with a gift from the Thessalonians, because it seems from now on that Paul devotes himself to full-time ministry and is freed from the necessity of earning his living. And that is a great encouragement to Paul. In fact, we read that. In verse 5, Paul devoted himself exclusively to preaching. Literally, he was held together. He was concentrated, body and soul, on the one great object of his mission, preaching. So there was increased activity. And increased activity leads to fiercer opposition. Taylor says, antagonism is the testimony borne to our earnestness by our opponents. That's a very perceptive phrase. Antagonism is the testimony borne to our earnestness by our opponents. Possible that Paul received another of his 39 stripes here in Corinth. In verse 6, he excommunicates the Jews, declares himself free of their blood, and moves next door to the synagogue to the house of Titius Justus, one of his converts. There's a small group of converts. You've got Crispus, the synagogue ruler, and his household. You've Titius Justus, you've Stephanus and his family, and you've others that we know of from the epistles. In these new surroundings, many pagans are converted, some of them from very degraded backgrounds. Romans 1 was later written from Corinth. Paul certainly had no illusions about paganism after living in that city. One of his converts was a man called Erastus, who's described in Romans 16:23 as the city's director of public works, the city's oikonomos. On the 15th of April 1929, American archaeologists uncovered a stone in Corinth with the name of Erastus, the city treasurer, on it. So it's an interesting confirmation of the accuracy of the scripture. Paul preaches Christ and him crucified, and this message is blessed by God. He's still apparently a prey to fears, and the opposition is increasing, so God gives him a very unusual method, or a message of encouragement. One night the Lord spoke to Paul in a vision, "Do not be afraid, keep on speaking, for I am with you. I have many people in this city." And this results in a pastoral ministry of about 18 months, a very fruitful and profitable time. The last feature I want to note, to stress, of Paul's ministry in Corinth, and a very significant one, is his interview with the proconsul of Achaia, a man called Lucius Junius Gallio.
And this is one of the key points in the chronology of Paul's life, because Gallio came to Corinth in July 51 AD. So if we're when we're trying to date Paul's life, that gives us one fixed point. This incident must not be before July 51, and it was within a few months after that. A very eminent man, a Spaniard, a younger brother of the philosopher Seneca, who was later to be tutor to the Emperor Nero. So Gallio was a very influential man in the Roman Empire. He's described in Latin literature as a man of integrity, a friendly and polite ruler. Gallio meets Paul when the Jews charge Paul with propagating an illegal religion. The Latin phrase, religio illicita, an illicit religion. Every religion in Rome, in the Roman Empire, had to have a sort of a license or a permission, and the Jews were allowed to practice their religion freely. This was a privilege granted by the Roman Empire. Now the Jews came and accused Paul of preaching an illegal religion. Gallio took a formal decision that Christianity was not an illegal religion. Gallio said that this was something that was not within his judicature. He did not wish to take any part in condemning the Christian religion. He said in the close of verse 15, I will not be a judge of such matters. And that is a precise Latin legal term. It means no Roman statute has been broken. He's not saying, I don't want to be a judge of this matter. He says it is not within the competence of a Roman court. Now this is of crucial importance, and this is why Luke stresses it, because this is, as it were, the stamp of approval of the Roman Empire on the Christian preaching. And Luke, of course, has an apologetic in mind towards Rome and towards the city of Rome. And here he says, one of the highest figures in your Roman bureaucracy has formally laid down that Christians may preach. So it is a very significant point. The representatives of Caesar will not interfere. At this stage, Rome is the protector of the Christians. And I think this is an important emphasis in Luke's writings. And then in the spring of about 52, Paul leaves Corinth. He had taken a Nazarite vow and wants to keep the Passover at Jerusalem. He discharges part of his vow by cutting his hair short at the harbour, and then he sails to Ephesus, where he leaves Priscilla and Aquila, speaks briefly with the Jews in the synagogue, is given a good reception, and promises to return. He then sails to Caesarea, travels up to Jerusalem, greets the mother church, fulfills his vow, and returns to Antioch, his home base, his second missionary journey. So really, the second journey of Paul, which we've covered this morning, we have the disagreement with Barnabas and the separation into two missionary teams. Paul and Silas set off up the coast. They strengthen the church in Derbe and Lystra, and they're joined at this point by Timothy. They preach in Iconium. They try to go west, they're not able to. They try to go north, they're not able to. They head northwest. At Troas, they're joined by Luke, and they have the vision that they're called to go into Macedonia. They sail to Neapolis. They meet with Lydia and the women at Philippi. There are a few converts. They are beaten after the miracle. They're put into prison. The jailer is converted. They have to leave Philippi. They preach in Thessalonica. Another church is formed there. They have to leave Thessalonica. Possibly Luke being left in
Philippi, Timothy being left in Thessalonica. Paul preaches at Berea, where Silas stays with the church, so you have the three churches. He goes down to Athens, little fruit. He goes to Corinth and stays there for 18 months. And a strong church is built in Corinth in that evil city.